Well, we come to the last of this series on Joseph. I hope you've enjoyed it and been learning some things out of it as we've been going through it these past 4 or 5 weeks. 4 weeks, but we had a break in between. Let me pray for us now. Father, again, speak to us. Show us your word and make it living in our lives and apply it in our lives as we listen and help us to act upon it. For Jesus' sake. Amen. Well, bad things happen to good people. An Australian missionary and his sons were bashed to death in India about 10, 12 years ago. You may remember it. A pregnant woman, more recently, has been sentenced to death in the North Sudan, or Sudan, for not being willing to renounce her Christian faith. In Nigeria, 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped. And I think we're still waiting for release. And a further 60 or so were further kidnapped this week, weren't they? By the... What's the name of the group? Baka Baham or something like that. And an upright and honest teenager was sold into slavery in Egypt by his jealous brothers. Well, we await the fate of the pregnant woman's verdict and the schoolgirls that have been abducted, and we pray for a good outcome on that. Yeah, she's had a baby, but she's going to be sentenced to death still in 2 years' time. You may recall that the missionary widow of the husband and sons that were bashed to death all those years ago has actually forgiven the murderers of her family. It's amazing. And the teenager in Egypt also forgave his brothers who so callously sold him off to slavery, as we read. How can it be that such evil acts, people can be so forgiving? How can people be so forgiving in such evil acts, and why? Well, Joseph has copped more than his fair share of problems, hasn't he? He's the teenager that was kidnapped and sent off to Egypt. At age 17, he was sold into slavery by his brothers who were jealous of him. You see, he was his father's favourite. He had a fancy coat, had a few fanciful dreams. Then, having made good, as we've seen over the past few weeks, he refused the sexual advances of Mrs. Potiphar. And as a result, he was thrown unjustly into prison where he languished. And then in his pleas of innocence to Pharaoh's cupbearer, who he's interpreted the dream of, he pleaded for release. And that release fell on deaf ears. So Joseph remained in prison for a further 2 years, where he was forgotten. If anyone should have reason to be bitter with God, who do you think it should be? Joseph. If anyone had good reason to get back at his brothers if he had opportunity to, Joseph did. And now he does have opportunity. You see, an extraordinary turn of events brings Joseph and his brothers together again. And as we've seen over the past few weeks, dreams for Joseph have been fulfilled. In the prison, the cupbearers have been fulfilled, been released and restored to the office of cupbearer for the king. The baker's dream has been fulfilled, which wasn't a very happy outcome, was it? He lost his head. And then the Pharaoh's dream, we see last week, has been fulfilled, which leads Joseph to not only being released from prison, but being put second in charge of all of Egypt. In fact, he's the prime minister of the land, only been under the rule of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's dreams were 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. There's one dream that remains unfulfilled, as we saw last week, and that is the dream that started this entire story, the dream of Joseph back in chapter 37. Now, 7 years of plenty have gone. The grain stores are full, as he interpreted in the dreams. Joseph, as the prime minister, has ensured that there's plenty of supply stored up so that in the years of the famine which they're now upon, there will be plenty of food. Well, that's in Egypt. Now, let's go back to Canaan, because in Canaan, the famine is hitting hard. And so 10 men, Joseph's brothers in actual fact, head off to Egypt because they've heard on the grapevine, except that the grapevine is withered and there's no grapes, that there is food stored up in Egypt for them to access in Egypt. So off they trot, and to go bring back food for their family and presumably their village as well. So they head off to Egypt. They come back before the man who is in effect the prime minister to ask to buy some grain. And so in verse 6 of chapter 42, we're going right back, we read this. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Do you get a sense of deja vu? Do you remember back in chapter 37, the dream that Joseph had that led to the jealousy and hatred of his brothers selling him off and so on? Joseph, you see, had boasted in a dream where he was a sheaf in the field and all the other sheaves that were his brothers were bowing down to him. And as he told that dream to his brothers, they were filled with jealousy and hatred toward him, remember? But here at last, some 20 years further on, the dream is fulfilled. And the brothers completely, unwittingly and unknowingly, for they don't recognize Joseph, come before him and they bow down to him as a mark of respect to the title he has, of the prime minister, if you like, of Egypt. And they come to buy grain. And when Joseph saw his brothers, he recognizes them, but they didn't recognize him. You see, Joseph's now dressed as an Egyptian. He's got those funny eyes, nice hair, really weird Egyptian clothes. He's shaved, and he was smooth. He had a man body, like mine. Why are they laughing? He was probably a bit more buff than me, that's correct. And we read in verse 7, as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Where do you come from? He asked. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and he said to them, you are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected. So he's really playing the game with them at the moment. And at the very point they bow down before him, the dream comes true. Yeah? They don't recognize him and he doesn't tell them who he is. Well, they go back to Canaan with their grain. Time passes and the famine continues. We know it lasts 7 years because we're told that as the readers. And they're back in Canaan. Their grain runs out again and they seek a return to Egypt. And this time, skipping a bit of the details, they bring back the youngest, Benjamin, the youngest of the 12, whose mother is Rachel, who died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin. And she happens to be the same mother of Joseph. And I imagine Jacob would have been reluctant letting Benjamin go, perhaps because Benjamin was the last connection he had with memories of his son whom he thought had been killed, Joseph. Anyway, Benjamin goes with his brothers to Egypt to ask again to buy grain with a famine, because the famine's continued on. And that's what happens in chapters 43 and 44. Now, when they get there, some things happen back in Egypt and they come before Joseph and various negotiations happen. And then in chapter 45, we go to the reveal. Oh, there's a text message from my dad. He's departing on time. There you go. They get to chapter 45 and they get to the reveal. And in the reveal that comes about, it's a bit like house rules where the contestants muck around all week renovating. In fact, they just stand there and paint every now and then on the camera while 100 other people do the work for them. But they're renovating all week and we get little snippets along the way with the final reveal coming usually on Sunday nights or Monday nights or something at the end of that particular week. Well, now here the great reveal is about to unfold before the brothers. You see, at the beginning of chapter 45, Joseph reveals his identity to them. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence!" So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him and Pharaoh's household heard about it as well. Well, it's a shock to all. And we read in verse 3, Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" He is. The plane's about to leave from Mackay. But his father, is he about to leave? Is my father still living? But his brothers weren't able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. How would you respond to this situation? The guy that you've sold off, now as the prime minister, you're bowing down before him asking for grain. How would you respond? Run, shock, and disbelief. His brothers certainly would never have expected to ever see him again, let alone as prime minister of Egypt. You see, I don't know if it's your experience, but in my experience, this sort of thing doesn't happen to many people. Family reunions are not usually this awkward. I've got a family reunion this week. Dad's on the plane. And my family is gathering from Queensland, New South Wales, and from Victoria for the first time in a few years, just before the wedding of Anna next Saturday. I don't think we're in for any surprises as we all catch up, and I certainly hope that the reunion will not be as awkward as this reunion is turning out to be. "Come close to me," Joseph said. When they'd done so, he said again, "I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt." I can tell you now, if I was one of those brothers before Joseph, I'd be terrified. I'd want to run like Wendy. Because Joseph is the one now who has the power to kill them. Because he knows the full story exactly of what has happened to him and how he's been treated for these past 20 years. Plenty of time to be angry, hey? He can make all sorts of accusations about them. He can put them on trial. He could probably just have them killed like that because he's the prime minister. But hear what Joseph says. "And now, don't be distressed. Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here. Because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land. And for the next 5 years, there will be no ploughing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of Egypt." That's verse 8, which I forgot to put in there. What is going on here is Joseph is revealing himself to his brothers, and he's saying a few things. First of all, he's not excusing the evil of his brothers, saying what you did is all right because that's what God wanted. No, he's not saying that at all. He's saying they're guilty of selling him into slavery and plotting to murder him. And their guilt, whatever it is, as terrible as it is in this situation, is not exonerated by God their guilt's not exonerated because God is involved in this. They are guilty, acting freely and responsible for their evil actions and intent. But the bigger truth that encompasses all of this is that God is the one who ultimately sent Joseph to Egypt. Not his brothers. And three times, Joseph makes that clear in his speech. "God sent me ahead of you. It was God who sent me here. And it is God who's made me father to Pharaoh." Here's a little snippet of what's true throughout the Bible. Human beings are responsible, always responsible for their actions. But God is still sovereign. And his sovereignty and our responsibility are not incompatible. They mesh together in some way. Maybe in ways that we cannot comprehend or rationalize, but nonetheless, from beginning to end of the Bible, it's true. And what we might do and intend as a wrong action, God might intend for other purposes, as we see here. So the two things, divine sovereignty and human responsibility, don't cancel each other out. When we rationalize the two, we shouldn't end up with some blend in the middle that is neither one nor the other. You see, both extremes are fully true. God is sovereign, and we are responsible. And any rationalisation by limited human minds, which you and I have, to try and bring the two together almost invariably fail at some point. And what's God's purpose in all of this? Verse 5 of chapter 45, it is to save lives or to preserve a remnant, as verse 7 points out. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. Well, it's about the preservation of life. The purpose for which God intended Joseph to go to Egypt was so that the family line would stay alive. Now, you might think that God had an easy way of doing this. You know, let Joseph get a little bit older, let Joseph go on a gap year, for example, do some travelling around the world, find a girl in Egypt, marry her, settle down. I mean, it sounds a bit easier doing it that way, doesn't it? It's what we do in our world today. We don't know why God intended it the way that he did. For the 20 years that Joseph was cut off from his family, if you like. But the purpose of it was so that the family line would stay alive. Remember who Joseph's great-grandfather was? Abraham. And do you remember God made some promises to Abraham? He promised that through Abraham's descendants, of which Joseph is one of them, the promises of God would find their realization for world history. And the promises are basically summed up in three things in Genesis chapter 12: the promise of land, the promise of blessing, and the promise of descendants, of people. But these promises here in Genesis with this Joseph story are in jeopardy. You see, what's happening with the land at this point in time? It's in severe famine. Abraham's descendants are starving to death. They've had to come back to Egypt to get more food. So God, in order to preserve that promised line, has made Joseph prime minister of all of Egypt. And interestingly, of all the people who deserve to die, Joseph's brothers, who wanted to murder him, which according to the Old Testament is what? Punishable by death? They're preserved. You'd think God would say, let's do away with the baddies, the brothers, and keep the goodies, of which there seems to be one. And let's have a sort of a moral cleansing or an ethnic cleansing, if you like. But no, such is God's grace that people who do not deserve it are kept alive. And such is God's faithfulness to his promise that he keeps even murderers alive. You see, human sin will not thwart God's promises. His brothers deserve to die due to their evil intent toward Joseph back in chapter 37. But nonetheless, God, who is faithful to his promise and who is gracious, keeps the evil work of these brothers and keeps them alive. The other extraordinary thing in Joseph's revelation of who he is to his brothers is that there is not a drop of vengeance. Why? Because he's secure in who he is. He knows that God is sovereign. Joseph knows that God is in control and that God intended what has happened for good. There's no place for vengeance when we know that God is sovereign. None whatsoever. Whenever we seek vengeance because someone wrongs us in some way, then we're in effect saying, God, you've got it wrong, and it's up to me to fix it. But when we trust in God's sovereignty and trust that things happen under God's divine and sovereign hand, there's no place for us to be full of vengeance at all. And Joseph is an illustration of that for all of us to take on board. Let me tell you that vengeance is a natural reaction when someone plots against us, when someone talks about us behind our backs. I'm paranoid about it. People talking about me behind my back, and I want to know. Vengeance is a natural reaction when someone scores points off us. But there is never any place for any Christian ever to exercise any vengeance at all. You got that? Never, ever. Joseph sends his brothers back to Canaan to get his father Jacob, and they bring him back to Egypt, which happens in chapter 46. And then over the course of the next three chapters, Jacob, Joseph's father, dies. An old man rejoicing that he's been reunited with his long-lost and favourite son. But he dies with the blessing on all his children in chapter 48 and 49. And then he's buried back in chapter 50 in Canaan. He goes from Egypt back to Canaan where he's buried. Well, as the story goes on, let me illustrate another story for you. I'm the youngest of four, and one time I came home from school with a mate. I was in primary school, I think, at the time. And my eldest brother got home earlier than me, and he ransacked our house, turned chairs upside down, threw clothes around the place and things upside down and stuff like that to make me think we'd been burgled when I got home. Now, the previous year, my dad had been to Mexico, and he brought back one of these Aztec calendars that was in a stone, a blue thing, and I thought it was worth millions of dollars. And I said to Darren, he'd come back, and I said, I think we've been burgled because of this thing, this thing that's there. And I panicked, basically. And Chris did this to get some payback on the things I'd probably done to him. And when your parents are around, siblings always love to pick on one another, don't they? Yeah? So that's what happened. Well, this time it was a joke that was a trifle overdone, because, you see, I panicked and I started yelling and shouting, not knowing what to do. And Chris, realising this in my utter desperation, then came into the room and confessed. Well, did I let him have it? I dobbed on him to mum and dad, and I wanted all the revenge I could get. And he'll be down here this week, and I bet you I'll give him more revenge. Tip a bottle of wine over him, I think. That would be too expensive to do that. But in a sense, that's a natural thing that happens in sibling rivalry and within human nature. Well, with the reading that Helen read to us this morning, this is what seems to be going on here as well. See, Jacob, I still noticed Helen had trouble reading it as well. Jacob, Joseph's father, has died, and the brothers, they're worried. They're worried that Joseph is still holding a grudge against them for all that they put him through. And now that Jacob's dead, they think that Joseph will now get payback on his brothers. So we read in chapter 50, verses 15 through to 17. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So, in verse 16, they sent word. Notice they send someone to Joseph, not themselves, the gutless wonders. They send an intermediary to Joseph saying, your father has left these instructions before he died. And I think that these are probably not what Jacob's sent. They are made up words and them to suit them. And they say, your father has left these instructions. This is what you were to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating us so badly, in treating you so badly. Now, please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. Again, it's probably an appeal to the characteristic of God being full of forgiveness and mercy. So therefore, they're saying, be like God and act with mercy and forgiveness as well to us. And Joseph's reaction? He bursts into tears, the little wuss. He cries, I think, because his brothers doubt his word. He cries because over the previous years leading up to Jacob's death, he has acted without vengeance and with integrity and honour. But when Jacob dies, they doubt him, and so he cries. He wept. And he goes on to reinforce what he said in chapter 45, and here in verse 19 he says, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" That is, it's God's place to take vengeance. Not mine, not Joseph's. Elsewhere, we're told in the Bible that vengeance is the Lord's. The brothers fear Joseph's revenge. But Joseph knows that vengeance is God's and God's alone. And so he goes on in verse 20 and says, "You intended to harm me." Or evil is the other translation you could use for harm. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." In order to preserve a numerous people as he's doing today. And again, notice the format there. He says, "You intended to harm me." You intended it for evil. Human responsibility is still there, isn't it? But God intended it for good. And so Joseph here forgives and refuses to exercise vengeance because that belongs to who? God. It's not a human being's responsibility to act with vengeance ever. That's God's business. And it's God's alone. In the same way, when Jesus was put to death on a cross, albeit unjustly, he said, "Father, forgive them, but they don't know what they're doing." Verse 20 isn't telling us that God thwarted evil in order to bring about good. The evil still happens, doesn't it? Joseph was sold, he was put in prison unjustly, he was forgotten in prison, but God didn't stop the evil happening, it happened. And this verse also does not say that God brings a good result out of a bad act. That is, as though somehow God is tidying up the mess that somebody else creates. It doesn't say, "You intended this for evil, but God has brought good out of it." Rather, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." That is, the evil itself is part of God's intent. It's not that the brothers intended evil and God says, "Look what they've done and how am I going to get this fixed up and stuff like that, all that sort of stuff." No, God intended all along the evil for good. That is, the evil intention of the brothers was fully part of God's purposes. All part of God's plan and purpose to ultimately bring good. At every point, bad or good, God is intending what happens in order that ultimately good comes out of it. Now, this is a very important lesson for us all to learn. We might be familiar in Romans 8, verse 28, which says this, "And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." Let me give you an example. Well, here's a bad event in my life. The vicar and his family are leaving the church. Now, I know that there's probably a huge amount of you saying, "Yay!" But there's some of you who are saying, "This is a bad event in my life." But let me tell you this. God is going to bring good out of it. Do you believe that? He's going to bring good out of it. This is saying, again, something deeper. It's saying that bad things are intended by God for ultimate good for his people. And it's very important that we get that right. Because if we don't get that right, when bad things happen to us, we will blame God, or we'll be vengeful, we'll be bitter or resentful, or we'll carry on that bitterness for the rest of our life to the grave. And what a waste of life. When bad things happen to us for whatever reason, God is behind it and God is sovereign. Very important to get that right in our lives because bad things happen to good people all the time. Most of us can give testimony to bad things in our life. I reckon we could just go around here and say, you know, we ask, "What's a good thing that happened this week?" I reckon you'd go around the room, we could say, "What's a bad thing that's happened this week?" And every one of us, without exception, could give us something. We cannot blame God for it, though. God intended Joseph to be sold by his brothers. God intended Joseph to wallow in prison for 2 more years in order to do good in the end. So we've got to have the worldview about us when we think about the world we are in, when we see disasters that happen around us, when we see injustice happen to others or ourselves, when we see unemployment, theft, or murder. Yes, there is full human accountability for all of those things and responsibility for such bad things happening around the world. But at the same time, God is sovereign and he is responsible for everything. And we also must remember that God is working for our good. How? When such bad things are happening to me? God is working for our good. He wasn't just working for Joseph's good or even Joseph's family's good. He works for the good of all his people. And that's why he created things in the first place. Here we are today at the end of Genesis, the last chapter, the very last verse, if you like, we've read of it. And one theme that brackets chapters 1 through to 50 of this book is God's goodness. You see, right at the very beginning, God made everything. And as he's making, what does he say? It is good. Then on the sixth day, he sees everything, humans as well, and he says, it is very good. And now we hear Joseph saying that God intended this for good. Because the work of the gospel, the work of redemption, the work of God's salvation in world history, the work of today is to work good for God's people and creation. As he began it with good, so he is working to restore it for good at the end as well. Goodness, you see, is part of God's essential character. So the psalmist invites us to taste and see that the Lord is good. Jesus tells his followers that he is the good shepherd, for example. And we're told that the news of Jesus' death and resurrection is what? Good news. It's the gospel, in fact. And so here in Genesis, we see that same gospel, that same good news at work. God making covenant promises with his people and keeping those promises, and he's working them out for the good of his people. The promises that there'll be descendants from Abraham, that promise is being worked out here now. That there'll be blessing through Abraham's descendants. Those who bless you, I will bless, says God to Abraham in Genesis 12. And that's what we find happening here through Joseph. And so too the promise of land. Though it's not been fulfilled at this point. Abraham was promised that he and his descendants would inherit the land, but here we find them all out of the land. And where does the book of Genesis end? Well, it ends at verse 26. So Joseph died at the age of 110. Wow. And after they embalmed him, because he was a bit Egyptian, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Joseph is dead. Joseph is embalmed. He's placed in a coffin, waiting to return to the land, which is not in possession. But it's a statement, if you like, in God's promises and good news, if you like, in God's gospel to Abraham, in effect. And when you get to the end of, we go a few books further on in the Old Testament, to the book of Joshua, several hundred years later, we find that Joshua and the people of Israel, they've conquered the land, they've entered into the land, have carried into Israel the coffin of Joseph, and near Shechem, they bury him. Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, and Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem in the tract of land that Jacob brought for 100 pieces of silver from the sons of Hamor, and so on. God is still working things for the good of his people. He's still keeping his covenant promises. And that's why Jesus came as fulfillment of the promises to Abraham, as good news and gospel for our good. So when bad things happen to good people, you perhaps might be good and incorporated in that statement, when bad things happen to good people. Don't blame God. Search to see his sovereign hand at work. Remember that, as the New Testament tells us, he's disciplining us for what reason? for our good. Let me read to you from Hebrews chapter 12. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you're not legitimate, not true sons and daughters at all. Friends, God has begun a good work in us and will bring it to completion on the day of Christ. He's equipping us for every good work and word. So pray to him that he may faithfully keep his promises for our good, and in the meantime, whatever bad things happen to us in the past, in the present, or in the future, let us, band, would you like to come in? Let us act with faith and with godly behaviour. Because that's what God wants from each one of us as his people. Act with faith and with godly behaviour. Don't have your poor little old me parties, which we all tend to do. But act and know that God is sovereign and that God is working for good, no matter what might be coming out of this. I'm going to stand and sing still. And we're going to let God minister to us and ask him to speak into our lives as we come before him and draw out, or let him draw out of us, that which we are holding a grudge against, or whatever it might be.